court. We'll proceed to the next case, the United States versus Malowika. Mr. Garlow.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, I'm Jonathan Garlow from Foley & Lardner on behalf of the appellant, Jadwiga Malowika. Mrs. Malowika was convicted of a nonviolent financial reporting offense for which neither the government, nor her bank, nor any other potential victim was deprived of a single dollar on account of her offense conduct. Mrs. Malowika was not accused, much less convicted, of engaging in any other illegal activities in connection with the structuring offenses. She has no criminal history. In fact, the district court found her to be a contributing member of society who operates a lawful small business. Based on her complete absence of criminal history and the relative lack of severity of her underlying offense, Ms. Malowika was subject to a guideline sentence of 0 to 6 months. Nevertheless, the district court ordered Mrs. Malowika to forfeit $279,500, nearly 30 times the maximum fine recommended by the sentencing guidelines. As a result, Mrs. Malowika, a cleaning woman by trade, is going to likely spend the rest of her life trying to pay off this insurmountable fine. The forfeiture was grossly disproportionate to the offense for which she was convicted and violates the Eighth Amendment's prohibition against excessive fines. It should be vacated.
Mr. Garlow,
yes, sir.
How much would not be grossly disproportionate, and how do we get to that answer?
Mm-hmm. That's an excellent question, and I think that question should first be posed to the district court.
Court punted on it.
That's absolutely correct, Your Honor.
That's kind of a punt on our part if we just say give it a shot. If we agree with you, you've got three former district judges sitting up here who remember what that's like and expect some guidance. So help us out here. If we were to agree with you, what should we tell them?
Well, I would first look, as the briefs bear this out, to the Bajakian case, which really is the sort of the cornerstone of the Eighth Amendment analysis.
Right, but that doesn't really give us much guidance as to figuring out what is permissible, because the court wasn't saying there that the $15,000 was okay.
That's true. That argument was not presented to the court. However, the argument was not cross-appealed. So it does give the court some indication that $15,000 sentence in relation to a $379,000 forfeiture order. I did the math a couple weeks ago, and I think it breaks down to about $70,000, applying the same ratio here. $11,000 here.
Well, there are a lot of different ways to do this math.
Sure.
I mean, this is a pretty serious problem with the Bajakian law that we've got to apply. Help us out here.
Well, I would point, in addition to the ratio, which was ultimately affirmed by the Supreme Court, although, as Your Honor notes, not squarely presented to that court, we've got several factors here that, in light of that case, suggest that a very small forfeiture amount would be appropriate. Certainly Mrs. Malowika's lack of criminal history, certainly the operation of a lawful business for which she's responsible for her children and her grandchildren, and in addition, the people who work for her. All those factors suggest that a small forfeiture that allows her to continue to operate that job is in benefits of the interests of not only Mrs. Malowika, but the society as well.
Do we have a finding here, Mr. Garlow, that these funds were not related to other crimes, or do we just have silence on that point?
I think the argument was made to the district court, but I don't believe we have a finding. I think it falls in the latter category of silence. As I indicated before, Your Honors, the touchstone of the Eighth Amendment analysis and the excessive fines clause is the Bajakian case. We briefed that case thoroughly, both parties in the briefs, and I won't belabor the facts too much in argument, only to note the significant commonalities that our case shares with Bajakian, which I think compel vacater of the forfeiture order here. First, the structuring offense for which Mrs. Malavica was convicted is a financial reporting requirement crime, nearly identical to the reporting crime at issue in Bajakian. That's what the 11th Circuit found in Ramirez, and that's the way it was described by the 4th Circuit in Ahmad, in United States versus Ahmad, citing the government's brief. Second, no harm was caused by the structuring transactions offense conduct. As the court stated in Bajakian, and applies equally well here, there was no fraud on the government, and the public fisc suffered no loss. Third, reflecting the relative lack of severity of Ms. Malavica's offense conduct and her complete lack of criminal history, her sentencing guidelines range was 0 to 6 months, and she faced a sentencing fine range of $1,000 to $10,000. By comparison, the defendant in Bajakian faced a sentence of 0 to 6 months and a fine of $1,000 to $5,000. Fourth, and what I want to focus on most, Mrs. Malavica's offense conduct was unrelated to any other criminal activity. And the government cites a number of out-of-circuit cases in its brief, but not a single one of those cases involves the scenario here, where the defendant was convicted of a criminal reporting, a financial reporting offense unrelated to any other criminal activity. That's the case here. That was the case in Bajakian. That was the case in the United States versus Ramirez case cited in our brief. And that's the case in a First Circuit decision, United States versus Perez, 183 F. 3rd, 22. It's a 1999 First Circuit case.
Well, what is the maximum fine for each count?
Your Honor, $250,000.
Each count, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And what MA counts was the defendant found guilty of?
23 counts, Your Honor. But I will caution that the Supreme Court in Bajakian pointed the court's attention not only to the maximum range, but also, but more appropriately, to the sentencing guideline range, and noted that the significant disparity between the maximum fine and the guidelines range pointed underscored that that particular defendant in Bajakian, and like Mrs. Malavica here, was relatively there's a relative lack of culpability as compared to other defendants who could have violated this crime. And I will also point out that the Second Circuit case, United States versus Costello, a case that the government relies on principally in its brief, noted that the court should pay its attention to the sentencing guidelines range rather than the statutory maximum. I want to discuss two cases cited by the government in its brief, because I think they illustrate precisely why this case is controlled by Bajakian and by Ramirez, and why the government's cases are sort of distinguishable. First, the Costello case, which I just mentioned to Your Honor. Although the government contends that that case is similar to this case, I think the facts bear out that this case is anything but. The defendant, Costello, as Your Honors are certainly aware, operated an unlawful check-cashing business in which, over a course of 9 years, cashed over $600 million in checks. The defendant repeatedly, that is, on literally thousands of occasions, cashed checks exceeding $10,000 without filing a CTR as required by federal law. The defendant's failure to file the CTRs was purposeful in that case. There's evidence that shows that the defendant in Costello charged his customers an additional amount to cash checks for over $10,000 because he knew of the CTR requirement and he knew the increased risk that he was taking on when he cashed those checks. But perhaps most notably, and again getting back to the point I want to focus on, the defendant Costello, in addition to failing to file CTR reports, was also charged with conspiracy to launder money, conspiracy to impede the IRS, obstruction of justice, tax evasion. No other charges were filed against Ms. Malavica in this case. Moreover, and similarly, the District Court and the Second Circuit in Costello noted that Costello defendant's failure to file those CTRs facilitated the fraudulent conduct of his customers. Again, no other additional illegal activity was facilitated by Ms. Malavika's offense conduct here. Now, I noted two aspects of the Costello opinion, which I thought I noted the first interesting aspect of the Costello opinion, and that is the Second Circuit's focus on the top of the guidelines range is the important metric for which the court to compare the penalties assessed by Congress. I also want to note that the Second Circuit's discussion of the CTR requirement, what that statute, why that statute was passed, underscores why Ms. Malavika is not the type of defendant who that statute was targeted for.
Now, evidence of the pattern. You don't think that that the number was 240 some withdrawals between $9,000 and $10,000. We nothing should be read in by the district judge as to intentional avoiding of the 40 requirement.
And Mrs. Malavika was convicted of that offense on that basis. But however, I'll note the Martinez case in which I cited. In the brief, the defendant was charged and convicted of 124 counts. Here it's 23, just 23 counts, so over 100 more counts in Ramirez than in our case. But the 11th Circuit there had no difficulty finding that the forfeiture was in excess of what the Constitution permits.
Was there evidence at the sentencing of her financial conditions?
There was, Your Honor, in the pre-sentence report noted in our brief that the pre-sentence report concluded that Ms. Malavika did not have the financial wherewithal to make the forfeiture payment and that she had a net monthly income clearing of approximately $450 a month. I see that my time's up. I'll leave the remainder of my time for rebuttal unless there are any further questions.
That's fine. Thank you, Scarlett.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the Court, opposing counsel. My name is Madeline Murphy, and I'm an assistant U.S. attorney, and I'm asking that this Court affirm the district court's decision not to overturn the jury's forfeiture verdict in this case, because that verdict was not a violation of the excessive fines clause. In a nutshell, Ms. Malavika, over the course of 6 years, committed structuring on no fewer than 244 separate occasions. She was charged with 23 of those occasions. The upshot of her conduct is that she pulled the wool over the eyes of the Internal Revenue Service for 6 years to the fact that she was dealing in large amounts of cash on a very regular basis, which is the type of conduct that Section 5324 is specifically targeting. She is precisely the type of defendant that statute is aimed at. In looking at the Bajikagian factors, it's clear that Ms. Malavika's conduct is very, very different from the conduct of Mr. Bajikagian. Mr. Bajikagian committed an offense on one single occasion. Ms. Malavika committed it on at least 244 separate instances. Mr. Bajikagian pled guilty to his offense, and when asked by the sentencing court why he committed the offense, he expressed that because of his background, he was an immigrant from the nation of Armenia. He was afraid of the government. He was afraid of government authorities. When Ms. Malavika took the stand at trial, she expressed that she did what she did. She chose the number 9900 again and again and again, 244 some odd separate times, because it was just a number. She could not come up with a credible explanation for what she did. In the case of Mr. Bajikagian, that statute, the bulk smuggling statute, was designed to ferret out essentially bulk smugglers of cash, such as money launderers, drug offenders, and what have you. It was an entirely different statute at issue in the Bajikagian case as opposed to the case at bar. The statute, as I mentioned earlier, at issue here, Section 5324, is aimed at ferreting out precisely the type of offender that Ms. Malavika is, the type of person who deals with large amounts of cash on a regular basis but does not want the Internal Revenue Service to become aware that they are dealing with large amounts of cash.
Are there any civil or criminal tax issues here?
Civil or criminal tax issues?
Tax issues with regards to Ms. Malavika.
Judge, we don't know.
You put her under quite a microscope, at least to find all these transactions.
Mm-hmm. We did, Judge. We put her under quite a microscope as to these specific transactions. We did not charge her with an Internal Revenue Service violation. We went on and charged her only with the structuring. I can't say, as I stand here today, whether there was an income tax violation or not.
But you all chose not to pursue any.
That is correct, Judge. We chose not to pursue.
Or Social Security or payroll taxes or anything like that.
That is correct, Judge.
What about her staff, whether they're employees or independent contractors? Were there any problems that turned up there?
She asserted at trial that she was not an employer. She ran an employment agency, that these people were not her employees, and that they were independent contractors, that she contracted the work out to. We did not, in this proceeding, pursue that issue. The district court drew the inference, which I think is a logical one, that she didn't pay any payroll taxes based on her assertions at trial that, oh, no, I'm an employment agency. I am not an employer. These are my independent contractors.
The government has chosen not to challenge her on that.
I'm sorry, Judge?
The government has chosen not to challenge her on that?
The federal government has chosen not to challenge her on that. That is correct, Your Honor. But if we look at the conduct that she did commit, we can't say whether she committed a tax violation. What we can say is that on 244 separate occasions, she committed the crime of pulling the wool over the eyes of the Internal Revenue Service, of deliberately choosing bank withdrawals in a specific amount so as not to trigger the currency transaction reporting requirement. The gist of the statute is that the Internal Revenue Service wants to know who's dealing in large amounts of cash, and she made it effectively impossible for 6 years for the Internal Revenue Service to determine whether she was, in fact, dealing with large amounts of cash. The defense stated that there are no cases where an individual had a forfeiture verdict in excess of the guidelines amount upheld by a higher court, and that is not correct. You are aware of the Ramirez case, the unreported 11th Circuit case that's been cited by the defense. In another case, the 11th Circuit came out in exactly the opposite, came out with exactly the opposite decision in a forfeiture case, cited in the government's brief, United States versus Hovind. Mrs. Hovind was charged only with structuring offenses and convicted only of structuring offenses. A forfeiture verdict was handed down in the amount of $430,000-some-odd as a result of, I believe, 45 separate structuring incidents. Mrs. Hovind challenged the forfeiture verdict as to her. She had not committed any other criminal conduct. She had not been charged with any other criminal conduct. The 11th Circuit chose to uphold that forfeiture verdict. It's clearly in direct conflict with the Ramirez case cited by the defendant. The 11th Circuit, in its reported decision of 219, I prefer to call this case the Wilton Manor case because I can never remember the actual street address that's in the title. The 11th Circuit noted that the maximum statutory fine is strongly presumptively reasonable when evaluating the propriety of a forfeiture order. The Hovind case follows that line of reasoning. The Ramirez case does not.
Right. How do we square that, though, with the Supreme Court's analysis in Bajikagian focusing on the guideline sentence as opposed to statutory maximum?
In Bajikagian, the Supreme Court said that both the guideline range and the statutory maximum are, quote-unquote, certainly relevant in the analysis. It's interesting to note that in the Bajikagian case, the $350,000 forfeiture order against him already exceeded the statutory maximum of $250,000 by $100,000. What the Supreme Court did in the Bajikagian case was look at that particular defendant's circumstances and that particular offense. It didn't lay down a hard and fast rule of this is always considered a violation of the excessive fines clause. It found that in Mr. Bajikagian's case, it was considered a violation because here we have a first offender who committed one offense and gave an understandable explanation for what he did. Now, the Bajikagian solution there, that a $15,000 forfeiture was appropriate, is not a one-size-fits-all solution to this situation. There's a case-by-case analysis. And in Mrs. Maluika's case, the Bajikagian solution does not fit her. This isn't somebody who made a mistake on one occasion. This is somebody who purposefully structured her behavior, no pun intended, on 244 occasions, who could give no legitimate explanation, no credible explanation for why she did what she did. She was convicted of 23 separate crimes, as opposed to Mr. Bajikagian's conviction of only one crime. And those 23 separate crimes came after a period of nearly 6 years where she committed the identical conduct, I believe, 221 separate times. So under the circumstances, it cannot be said that the punishment that she incurred here, the forfeiture of the $279,000, is, quote, unquote, grossly disproportionate to the criminal conduct that she committed. This was a long series of criminal conduct. It wasn't a single instance. It was not in excess, certainly far less than the actual money that was structured over that period of time. I believe $2.4 million was the total amount of the cash that she structured over the period of time. Excuse me. It was well below the statutory maximum. She was convicted of 23 separate counts, and I believe the statutory maximum fine, if we multiply 23 by $250,000, is $5.7 million. It was approximately 5% of that. It was about 11 or 12% of the total amount of money that she actually did structure.
Is the government then... Does the government question that pre-sentence conclusion of her worth at the time of sentence?
Actually, Your Honor, if you look at the pre-sentence investigation report, Ms. Maluika owned, I believe, about $900,000 worth of real estate. Of course, the real estate market, as we all know, has its ups and downs. And what was worth $600,000 18 months ago may not be worth that now. But still, she owned two pieces of real estate, which collectively were valued, I believe, one at $600,000 then and the other at $400,000.
The suggestion of this from Mr. Garlow of her income, that's just based on her business not being non-existent now? Is that he gave us a $400 a month figure, I think, from the pre-sentence report. I haven't examined that.
I believe that was her monthly cash flow, and that was not a
after
reflection.
After expenses, that's the net cash flow.
That is my recollection, Judge, but it did not take into account the fact that she had some fairly sizable real estate holdings.
Was there a concern of the government that all these transactions may have resulted as a concern, perhaps in other cases, of money leaving the country?
We had no evidence in this case that the money was intended to leave the country, Your Honor. The evidence, it did appear that she was paying these independent contractors with the money. The government is more concerned with the conduct here. Over the course of 6 years, she worked very hard to avoid having the IRS know that she dealt in cash on a regular basis. She went to the bank three or four times a week over the course of 6 years and took steps which I believe in Cassano, this court, stated words to the effect of it strains credibility that the inconvenience and difficulty of making these arrangements again and again and again and again and again was anything other than purposeful behavior.
She was not charged with any income tax violations, though, was she?
That is correct. She was not charged with any income tax violations, Your Honor. But if we look at the conduct that she did do, she committed 23 separate crimes, and there's evidence based on the 404B evidence in the trial that she committed 244 separate crimes. If you look at the criminal conduct that she actually did commit, true, it was all structuring, but still that is a long and extensive history of working very hard to avoid letting the IRS know that she's dealing in large amounts of cash.
Is there any theory that she benefited from doing this?
It's entirely possible that she did benefit from doing this, Your Honor, that in considering these cleaning women to be independent contractors, she avoided paying payroll taxes, paying Social Security, acting as an employer for them. This was a concern that the district court had at sentencing, but this is beyond the evidence at trial, Your Honor. So all in all, I will ask that this court affirm the district court's verdict and upholds the forfeiture determination of $279,500.
Is her business still in operation?
That is my understanding, that her business is still in operation, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Ms. Garlow, I think your time had expired, but you may have an additional minute.
I appreciate that, Your Honor. Thank you.
Your Honor, I believe, with all due respect to Ms. Murphy, she was incorrect in stating that the pre-sentence report did not take into account the real estate holdings of Ms. Malavica. I'm reading from the final analysis from that report, and it says, the defendant is subject to forfeiture in the amount of $279,500. Based on the information provided by the defendant with respect to her income and assets, it does not appear the defendant has the ability to make a lump sum payment towards the forfeiture amount. That's where that comes from. The second point, Your Honor, again, I'll quote from the Costello case, the Second Circuit case on which the government relies heavily. The relevant metric is the sentencing guidelines. It's not the statutory maximum. And finally, just to respond to the government's point that this defendant was the type of defendant who's the target of statute 5324, that could be equally said of the defendant in Bajakian, who was carrying cash overseas. There's no dispute about that. That statute was geared towards ferreting out that information, but the court said, look, this statute is really about ferreting out tax evaders or racketeering activity, and that's not what this person is. Likewise, Ms. Malavica is a small business owner. She's not a tax evader. She's not a racketeer. She's not a drug trafficker. She's not a money launderer.
Thank you, Ms. Garlow. Thanks to all counsel. Ms. Garlow, you have the additional thanks of the court for accepting this appointment. All right. The case is taken under advisement, and the court will stand in recess.